Every day, millions of men go to work questioning their purpose and how to leverage their gifts for the advancement of God's kingdom. Join us as we hear stories from other men just like you and me who have discovered the answer and are willing to share some wisdom they've learned along the way. Gathering wisdom is like dropping pennies in a jar. Over time, our jars fill up and overflow into the lives of others. Welcome to The Drop.
Welcome to The Drop. My name is Michael Pick, and today we're joined by Ken Peterson. How you doing, Ken?
I'm doing great, Mike. Good to be here, buddy.
All right, thanks for coming. Hey, Ken, why don't you start us off by telling us a little bit about your family?
My family, well, born and raised, my family came from a little town of Salinas. You guys probably know it up the road. Most law enforcement knows it because of the crime nowadays. But it was a little town, about 70,000 people. I'm number five out of six in my family. And so that's where we started. I got two older sisters and three brothers. So that's the start of my family. Then here, I'm married, been married for 21 years. My wife, Margie. We have two boys and a girl. And so, yeah, got a 20. He just turned 20. 20, 18, and 16-year-old in the gang. Yeah.
And you guys live locally?
We do. We live in Arroyo Grande. Just up on like Stagecoach in that area right there. Yeah, not too far.
So 21 years, congratulations.
Thank you. 22 is around the corner next month. So.
That's a heck of an accomplishment.
Yeah, so far so good.
How did you get from the valley or the Salinas Valley to the Central Coast?
Yeah, good question. It's kind of a roundabout. I was accepted to Fresno State, go Dogs, and a lot of my friends from Salinas were ag or other things. They came to Cal Poly. So I would come visit because Fresno is an oven in the summer and a freezer in the winter. And so I come out here and the weather was nice. And I really enjoyed the green hills and the people were good folks and the temperatures were great. And I had a sister living in Grover, so I visit her too. And it just was in my deep down, like, I want to live here. I really hope it works out to live here. And of course, you know, everybody says there's no way it'll happen. So that's kind of how it began that way. And then I went to grad school up in the Bay Area for optometry. And again, it's just like, where do I want to live when I don't want to live for the rest of my life. You know, there was a time I could have, and it's just still San Luis Obispo County, someplace was still in my heart. And again, people were still saying, you're not going to make it. And I thought there was an opportunity to buy an optometry practice down here, and that was my ticket down. That's where kind of it all became the beginning of my being here. So,
okay.
Yeah.
How long ago was that?
That was 1995. So, yeah, 26 years. Kind of went backwards. Funny, when I got here, I kind of found out that you usually move here after you get married and have kids. Well, I had neither. I was single. I met my wife in a singles group, fortunately, by the grace of God down here, and then we started a family. So I kind of went a little bit backwards, but the big thing was to move here and, you know, get established.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're five of six kids, is that right?
Exactly.
Okay. Where do your siblings live out in the United States?
They live anywhere from as north as Spokane, Washington, and then as south as Costa Rica.
Okay.
So we got some family there. I have a brother still in Salinas living there.
Okay.
Special needs. And have a sister living in Grover Beach. So okay. We're kind of that state west side.
Okay.
West of the Rockies there. Yeah.
So out of high school, you go to Fresno.
Yes.
And what did you study there?
I was a biology major. I did biological science. I was thinking about pre-med. And so it was in this other, like a functional biology, which is really hard. And then it just kind of went from this scene that I was trying to study to get A's, and it wasn't working to want to go to med school. And so eventually trickled into optometry, which my dad actually recommended for me. It's pretty interesting because he kind of saw that it's healthcare, it's science, it's biology, but it's not 9 to 5 and you're not killing yourself to work weekends and have pagers. And it actually was a great advice from my father. And
so when did he give you that advice to go into optometry?
I was going through my sophomore year at Fresno State, and again, just killing myself to try to get A's because I, go to med school and got to get these A's, and just was burned out. And so I had at least I don't know if people have called, they call it the sophomore blues, where you just mm-hmm. have this, that second year in school, and why am I here? What am I doing? So I had one of those moments where I basically just kind of took some easy courses and didn't do a lot of units and had a semester. Thank you, Dad, you paid for it. and in that time, that's when my dad introduced it to me. And so that's when I started pursuing optometry. And oddly enough, once I kind of took the pressure off my back, I took the same courses I could have taken for med school, but my grades got better and I had a much better college life and a great experience. So it wasn't just this academic, you know, put my nose to the ground and not you know, expose, you know, enjoy the fruits of being in college and enjoy that experience.
Sure. Yeah. So initially when your dad recommended this, which was great advice, obviously you've had a great run.
Sure.
Were you like, what's optometry? I mean, did you know what it was? Yeah. Did you have any idea?
Well, I barely knew how to spell it.
Okay.
Luckily I got that, and that's one of the first things they teach you in optometry. But it was kind of nice. My dad told me about it, and then actually there was in his office group, he had an optometrist, and this optometrist took me to lunch, and the guy was really my inspiration to become an optometrist. I actually was volunteering. He let me sit on a patient and watch him do his work, and I watched his interaction with patients and just helping people see. I mean, it's so interesting. It's such, you don't think about how powerful it is to see, and it seems like it's pretty trivial because I just do it so much, but the results and the satisfaction from patients, and watching him do that, I could see myself, and just and having a personal relationship with the patients was really fun.
Okay.
And so even when I got accepted, my dad said, you got to tell Jim Hicks, Dr. Hicks was his name in Salinas, and so I went and told him right away, and he was a Cal grad too, so pretty fun.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you had some good advice. You followed through, got a little inspiration from a mentor.
Big time.
And where did you end up going to earn your doctorate?
Doctorate was in at University at Cal Berkeley.
Okay.
So
all right.
I'm a bulldog and a bear.
Dog and a bear.
And a bear. So when they play each other, I'm kind of torn on who to root for. So I went there did my 4 years of my grad school up there, and then got my doctorate in optics. And that was it. So back in 1992, so got that.
Yeah. So how does it work? So you get an undergraduate degree, which in biology, then you got your doctorate, and then and then are you licensed to be an optometrist?
You are. You are definitely. Optometry, fortunately, I got my degree because I wanted to fall back just in case. I thought I'd be a high school biology teacher. Mm-hmm. But fortunately for optometry, at least back then, I didn't have to. But it was nice. I got that, so I got my degree. But I'm sorry, what was the question?
So the process.
I'm sorry, yeah. So basically get the doctorate, you get licensed, and then, you go out to practice. Some people will go into residencies and specialize or, you know, become, you know, professors or, you know, lab clinicians and whatnot, but I didn't. I just got my degree and
started
moved
working.
On. Yeah, started working. And my goal is always to get own a practice. You know, some folks, all the smart people, they did, they became instructors at the school and whatnot, but that was my goal, just to get out and find a place to live and run my own business. So
walk me through a typical day. Like, how was your day-to-day as an optometrist? Yeah. What do you do as an optometrist?
Yeah, it's interesting. The typical day, it's funny, I guess I'm not such a typical optometrist. There's the private practice. The typical day there is, you know, going in, seeing patients, maybe 10 to 12 patients a day. It could be a full exam. It could be a contact lens check or fitting. It could be a glaucoma workup. I mean, there's different facets because we've gotten a little more medical since I've graduated, and it was kind of where optometry's gone, even though we're still, you know, glasses, contacts, optics, that's kind of where we are bread and butter. But today I was at Atascadero State Hospital, so I'm up there doing eye exams on patients, mentally ill patients, and so that was a whole day of seeing those folks. And you change gears a little bit, but your goal is to help them see and to take care of their eyes. And no matter what shape, size, whatever people they need to see and have healthy eyes to see. And so I try to have that there. I've done nursing home work. I've worked at county jails before, done some work there and seen some unique things there too. But again, the basics is just, you know, treat them like a human being, get them, you know, help them see. And that's really the big push I always have in my heart, is to get them to get some nice glasses and get them seeing better, you know, really pays off. Yeah.
So it's very satisfying.
Yeah, it is. That part is. Now, when somebody puts a pair of glasses on and sees for literally the first time, I had that yesterday, some teenage boy had an eye condition. It's called keratoconus. And his eyes cone. It's like a cone shape, and he's never been treated, and he didn't know he could see any better. And then we put these special contact lenses on him, and he put the first lens on, and he lit up. Like, he could not believe. It's like, also, his eyes were supercharged, or think the word. But yes, that part is very satisfying. And be able to be that guy to help that person out or get the referral to the ophthalmologist when you saw it first. Yeah, that's really something, Mike.
So what's the difference between an optometrist and an ophthalmologist?
Good one. Besides the spelling, which,
yes.
Again,
Don't test me on that.
I kid you not. When we were in school, they had to spell optometry and ophthalmology. Like, my eye anatomy was like, here's how you spell this. And so, yeah. Optometry's foundation and basis is optics. It's bending light and helping people see that way. So we refract patients, which means bending light, to create a focal point on the retina so that people can have a clear image of whatever they're seeing or need to see. Okay, so that becomes glasses, which that was our bread and butter. And then contact lenses also came into the picture. So that's optometry, that's our basis. Ophthalmology is more medical, health, surgery. They're the medical folks. Like, if we have somebody with a bad eye, you know, before we would send them ophthalmology and they would do the surgeries or treat with the medications and things. So that's the basics of our work. So
thank you for the simplified explanation. I'm sure it's more complicated than that. I appreciate it.
In some ways. Well, it's kind of what's happened to you, Mike, is that optometrists try to do a little more ophthalmology. It's kind of weird. Like, we're doing like glaucoma, which is fine, but, you know, so we do more of that with our optics. And so an ophthalmology has kind of swung and done a little more like eye exams and things. It's interesting, but we're still, those are our basics, you know, and they're pretty interesting, yeah.
Thank you. So let's pivot a little bit and talk about your faith.
Yes.
So did you come from a faith-based background? How did you come to know the Lord, et cetera?
Yeah, very good. That came through, we were raised like very, my dad was always got us to church. We were raised in a Presbyterian church, baptized there up in Salinas. And so we were there 8 o'clock every Sunday, sometimes early, because my dad was always a morning person. Not too often, because there's no way I'd get up at, be at the church at 7:30 sometimes. So that was the basis of things. So I knew of, you know, of God, of church, of sin, of hymns, and, you know, there was a very ritualistic part of the service that I knew of. But I didn't know, it was not until Young Life actually came around. I knew of the things in the Bible, and they gave me one, and I read it. But it wasn't until I got into Young Life, and then that changed everything. There was like this God that was supposed to be really far, far away, that's this powerful, not, I don't think it's an entity, I get that, but just like a person I can envision and imagine. Young Life put a face and a name and a relationship to that. It was really, really mighty how Young Life did that. And it was just right up my alley. And my mom prayed for me, she said, years ago, before I got into Young Life, and we knew some people. And that's where I started to pursue my relationship with the Lord. It was through that organization, and really awesome. And then what was really great too is once I became a Christian, they said, go back to church, you know, and sadly, churches, these back then had this issue, like it was almost a competition. Young Life was a competition for the youth group, and really, it was really disappointing because a lot of us went back into church. Yeah, anyhow.
So how old were you when you first started going to Young Life?
About 16.
Okay.
16 years, yeah.
And that's when it really was a pivot point for you, where you really encountered Jesus for the first time.
Yeah, very, very much. Yeah, my family, what happened, we all have things in our family, and it's a broken world, but my parents divorced when I was 11 years old, and that kind of sent me into a little bit of a tailspin as a kid, you know, and so I became this much mature, take care of my life, very serious on things, and Young Life was able to, God was able to use Young Life to kind of get me to be a kid again and enjoy that and see Christ, and so it was really helpful in that manner, yeah.
So how have you continued to be engaged with Young Life as you've become a professional?
Well, one is because I am a professional, I support them.
Okay. Yeah,
so there's always a financial side of that thing.
Right.
I remember that was always the biggest thing when with all the leaders I had, is just the finances and the fundraisers.
Sure.
I believe in the group, I support the group. If something's coming up, I'll back them, I'll help out. Chris Bradley, you know, we rob a lunch every once in a while. He's the new area director now.
Right.
So pretty cool there. I wish I could volunteer, but I think I just don't have the ability. And I think when you kind of get at a certain age, you're doing youth work as a certain age of adulthood, it doesn't, it's you need younger people in there that are more engaged that way. But try to support them that way, pray for them, and yeah.
Either. So yeah. Let me ask you something. Yeah. Earlier you said that the church you were raised in was very ritualistic.
Yeah.
And I kind of take that as kind of flat and not full of life.
Yep.
So what would you tell somebody that's maybe in a church, younger than you, mm-hmm. that has that same feeling about going to church as ritualistic, religious,
yeah.
religiosity? What did it take for you to break out of that, to realize this fulfilling relationship was there?
Good question. For me, it was Young Life. There's actually another group out there that showed me another side of Christ. You know, it was great, and actually, it was kind of weird, but that was, yeah, Young Life helped out. Even like a youth group within the church was really fun, because mm-hmm. after I became a Christian, I would go back to church and things was lit up. Like all of a sudden stuff made sense. The pastor made sense, even though it was hard to hear the sermon sometimes, kind of mundane. But the youth groups that were there, in the fellowship with other kids, I think that was really a big deal instead mm-hmm. of just the worship service. You know, there's more to the church than that.
Do you still yeah. keep in touch with the Young Life leader that you met when you were 16?
Yes, I do. I actually supported him a couple different times, and we through Facebook a little bit, but yeah, it was really great. I was plugged up in the Bay Area, in Young Life, and I told these guys about this guy, Joe Walters, that's who helped lead me to Christ, and they go, you got to write that guy a letter, tell him you're following Christ, and the guy, he actually came and visited me. It was really, he was in the area, but we had a good get together, and yeah, we still have Christmas cards, and it's pretty amazing. Yeah,
how cool. 16. Yeah. 16. I mean, that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, you have this encounter with Jesus. You dig into a career, and you start building your practice, which we could throw a rock at. It's very close to here.
So I can't be late.
Right.
Ever to church. So, it's right down the road. Yeah.
Tell me about how that relationship with Jesus plays out on a day-to-day basis in your practice.
Yeah. I see.
No pun intended.
No pun intended. That's okay. Yeah, that's good. Watch out for the jokes. They're even worse. All right, no. What I notice is that people are concerned, they're fearful, and they need a calming voice or somebody to listen to them. It's really, people aren't listened to too often, and I think a lot of us can step over and try to correct things. And I've noticed that also, I'll pray for you, and I prayed with people in the chair, and most people have been great. One person, go for it, but it was really that's where I see my faith kind of playing out in my career. Like we're an office that is welcoming. We want people to be there. We want to have people enjoy the time, and know that they're appreciated, and that we're grateful that they're there. Like Christ, Christ was like, he just was magnetic. I mean, people want to be by the guy, and that's. I want our office to kind of have that vibe to it. Yeah.
So how do you do that as a leader of your office? The practitioner. How do you do that? What kind of things, mandates do you set? Habits do you set to instill that?
I try to go off of just trying. What are my gifts? And the only one gift I tend to see come up is encouragement. So I try to encourage my staff. I encourage my patients. Good job. When you're doing the exam and trying to bring that in. I hope that answers the question, but
yeah,
I think
does.
So. That's what I bring into the place. And again, just trying to be something it's a happy place. It's a good place to be, cause some of the world is such a downer as we know. And it continues to be that way and divisive. And I just want it to be something where whoever comes in, you're included and involved and you're important,
Yeah. So as a father of three, and you got young adults in your home, teenagers as well, I should say. Yeah. So how is it that you've been intentional about approaching your role as a father and a husband so that maybe that ritualistic religiosity that you were raised in hasn't dripped over to them? What kind of things do you do in your family?
Be real. Mike, be real. You can't fool your kids. My parents never fooled me, I'm not going to fool my kids. And so, my whole goal, and again, it goes back to Young Life's mission, is they present the gospel of Jesus Christ to somebody and they take it from there. If they follow it, great. If they don't, but that's what I wanted to do. I want my kids to know Christ, know of Christ, go to church, get involved, and then from there, I pray they follow Christ the rest of their lives. But, it's a certain point where it's the Holy Spirit's it's on the Holy Spirit and them making their own decisions. And so I'm really kind of watching that right now as they t- take off. Luckily, you know, Jake is, it's great. My oldest kid is at Texas Christian, so
fantastic. I guess
that's kind of worked out. So he's in youth groups. He's in groups now at that group, at that school. So that's pretty nice. And I told my kids one, I said, you know, my thing is just to show you Christ, and you decide after that. I can't force you into this thing, you know. It's just not, it just doesn't happen that way. And I wasn't forced to. The beautiful thing with my relationship with Christ is it was me making the decision, not because about 20 other people were going to, you know, billy club me. No, they wouldn't have, but it just, you know, that's where I came to know Christ. Yeah.
That's a great answer. And I want to follow up a little bit. So being real, authentic in your home, does that mean things are off limits or nothing's off limits with your kids? I mean, what does that look like to be authentic in your home when the pressures of life and setting an example, et cetera? What does that look like?
It's very humbling because you have to, they see you make a lot of mistakes. You have to apologize. What I watch is I have to apologize quite a bit because I've made the mistake. It's not me being the, you know, the dad and the overseer and the, you know, the whatever, and just this ogre over my kids, and they can't do anything about it. I really try to be more vulnerable with them that way, and know when I screwed up. You know, I remember one time, I think Josh, I said something or did something with him like one night, and I knew he felt bad, and he was like 8 years old, and I said, I gotta confess, I need to apologize to somebody at this table, and it's Josh, and his lit up, he smiled, and he, you know, like I was apologizing to my 8 year old, and it's just, that's what I think you gotta do. And there's a lot of forgiveness in there. And I gotta forgive my kids too, because, you know, we all make mistakes, and, you know, watch out the pressures I put on them.
Yeah. Right.
In there. Cause it's easy to, when you run your own office, you're the dictator and you can run things. You come home and you gotta drop that.
That dynamic's different.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So how did you learn that lesson? How did you, your approach to parenting is just to be real, you know, and being a husband. What was it that was significant about your walk with Christ that taught you that lesson?
I think it was watching the pride my father had, you know, of not wanting to make the mistake and not apologizing. Or if you try to approach him about something, he just had a way of it going back at you. And I think I didn't want that. I know I have it in me, because I'm sure I'd still do it, even though I'm probably in denial. But I want to, the kids know there's a part of me that is that way. It's going to apologize and concede that I made the mistake, you know, in there. But it's tough. It's a challenge thing. Cause there's parts of, like I said, everybody's got their parent in them.
Right.
Yeah.
So. Well done on that. So, thanks. You know, looking as we're sitting here talking, you know, it seems like you've had some kind of major steps in your life. Young Life was one. Mm. Meeting this mentor that kind of turned you on to your career.
Yeah.
Looking at those two places, what would you look back? What kind of advice would you give yourself, maybe as an 11-year-old that's going through a divorce, a 16-year-old that's finding their identity in Christ, and then a sophomore in college that's trying to figure out, where do I fit?
Yeah.
What kind of advice would you relay to those younger you?
Yeah. You are important. You have meaning on this planet. You are somebody. You're not a nobody. And you're going to contribute great things. Not going to, you are and will and have. You know, I really, again, it's a big deal for youth to not think it's their future. They're now, you know, doing stuff. And I think 11-year-old has an important contribution, you know. And again, going back to Young Life, I love what the beauty of Young Life, again, and anything, I'm a very relational guy, Mike, is that I really love pouring into the kids and seeing what they're doing with their lives, because I'm not there anymore. I've got my routine, my habit, and I love the creativity and the gift and things. I get bummed when they get stifled. You know, it's really unfortunate. So that's the advice. But just let them know they're important. There's a plan, and they're a part of of God's great commission for all of us. You know, So
that's very good advice. So Ken, we've been talking a lot, and you've really been really transparent about some of the meaningful events in your life. But now, you know, I see you as a great success story. Yeah. You know, you're a dedicated family man, dedicated father, you run a great practice. But now your children are about to be adults.
Yeah, no kidding.
So what is next?
Yesterday.
You know, looking forward to those pivotal moments, what are the next pivotal moments you see coming?
Yeah,
and then you prepare for it.
Well, one is for my wife's grandkids. I'll be in there. I've thought about it a lot, Mike, because what I've always heard and people said too is when you retire, you don't retire, you redirect. You don't want to just retire and be done with your, you know, that all shrivel up. So what I've always wanted to do and get back into is some sort of ministry of some sort. You know, it's work at the church or, you know, like discipling, you know, young professionals or anything like that, where I'm using what God has given me and bringing that back to, you know, the group. And like Bruce Terrell, he was that kind of guy to me for some time. Really great. And just to bounce stuff off of, he's been there, done that. And to just apply what I've learned. But it really, it's an exciting time. I think it will be just to do that. But just to have that as a next step. You know, I'm not a builder. I like to cook, but I'm not going to build stuff.
So planning on using the gifts, your relational gifts, and your passion for Christ for someone else.
Yeah.
Really, that's the goal.
I would. No, I'd love it. It's really just something. I remember, because I guess people spoke to me that same way. I was some mentors through the years. And Bay Area had a really great group of guys. This one guy, Bob Martin, who sadly passed from pancreatic cancer a number of years ago. But he was our guy. He was like, they call him our father in Christ.
Okay. Yeah,
and so I saw that. I would love to have that, to be able to do that to the generation below me, or you know, have that as part of my repertoire, I guess.
Thank you for sharing that. So final question.
Okay.
So, you know, you've talked a lot about helping people see. What is that moment like when, for the first time, you get to help someone see?
Yeah.
What is that like?
It's insanely fulfilling, Mike. It's amazing. What a couple of Kate probably mentioned, there's a boy that came in today or yesterday that had a condition called keratoconus. I told you about that. And he put the contacts on, and first time he's looking at my, when I stopped, was, I can see the strands of hair in your head. I mean, you don't think about that stuff. And it was so fulfilling. He was so grateful and so thankful. And I got to be a part of that segue. And, you know, I have my labs, I have my people, but really to have that, very, very satisfying. Again, I had somebody that I was looking in their eye, and they said, I can't see it. Well, I found a tumor. I mean, it was really scary, and got them to the specialist, and it saved their eye. I mean, so being that kind of a gatekeeper, because it really considers primary eye care. And so we're kind of somewhat a gatekeeper to referrals and whatnot. And cataract surgery, same thing. The cataract surgeries are so great. The ophthalmologist, the implants, the experience. And when they can come out and they just see the colors, like the blues are back. And like I said, one gal worked at one of the pharmacies here, and she didn't have a lot of money. She paid good money for these lenses, and she said it was well spent. She actually cried in the chair. Like, I can't believe how well I see. It was such a touching moment there, you know. So yeah, very much that. It's pretty amazing, and it's almost unbelievable that I'm allowed to be a part of that process with these folks. Yeah, really something.
Man, I can't help but think of Jesus' miracles of turning the blind to see. It's just so relevant. I don't know why I'm fixating on it, but it's incredible. What an incredible gift.
Powerful. Actually, there's a patient came in that was a missionary, and she used that because they would do cataract surgery and lead people to Christ. Like, this is Christ, you know, removing helping you see from being blind, and a lot of folks came to know the Lord that way. Pretty meaningful. Yeah.
All right, Ken, so we've been sitting here for a while, and I really appreciate your time. We have this little tradition we do on the drop. So this jar kind of represents the wisdom we're collecting,
right,
and there's some pennies in it.
Right.
So metaphorically, if you don't mind dropping a penny in it, because you've shared some wisdom on our path.
I would love to.
All right.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Ken.
And Mike, thanks again. No, awesome.
Blessings.